with our program. We are not doing the third, we are at least 15 minutes late. Maybe we should apologize for that. I see some of our guests that is invited have not yet arrived. They might arrive or they might not arrive. We do have some apologies from some of them. See, the honorable members are here. A few of the members have not yet arrived. I don't know whether we've got apologies. We don't, from the members. But we are glad and grateful that all the panelists invited are here. They are going to share with us their thoughts around the question relating to Ryan Coaching. Let me take this opportunity to welcome and acknowledge the presence of the Honorable Minister of Environmental Affairs, Honorable Edna Molewa, Honorable Members of Parliament, the Director General, and all officials from the Department of Environmental Affairs, and all staff members from Parliament, all our invited guests, and the stakeholders in the conservation environmental sector. My apologies, Honorable MEC. I've been made aware that we've got an MEC from Northern Cape. My apologies, Honorable MEC. I was not made aware of your presence. The media is present. Ladies and gentlemen, the colloquium that we are hosting today is the first in a series of seminars that we as the portfolio committee will be having every parliamentary quarter. The intention is to create a national platform for debate and dialogue between government, parliament, and civil society around key issues facing our society in the environmental sector. In doing so, we seek to make our contribution towards finding a lasting solution to the challenges facing our country. In this connection, we would like to see parliament becoming a true people's parliament. A parliament that is activist in character and orientation, a parliament that promotes public engagement and participation in key topical questions of the day, a parliament that is accessible to our people, a parliament that is relevant and makes its contribution to the ongoing intellectual discourse around environmental issues in our country. We hope that as a portfolio committee of this parliament, we will do our best towards attaining the ideals that I've just articulated. South Africa is the world's most successful conservation record for rhinos. In 2011, this country alone conserved 83% of Africa's rhino population and 73% of all wild rhinos worldwide. As one of the most biologically diverse nations, South Africa has a long history of promoting biodiversity conservation through the sustainable use of natural resources. However, the country's excellent conservation records, particularly of the rhino species, is under serious threat. Some people argue that growing illicit market for rhino horn in the past years is largely attributed to the economic boom in East and South Asia, where the horn is apparently used for medicinal purposes. The statistics from 2007 to date seem to support this hypothesis. In 2007, South Africa lost 13 rhinos to poaching. By 2009, the number had reached 124. In 2010, it rocketed up to 335, and the numbers continued to rise in the subsequent years. Poaching statistics rose sharply to 1,004 killed rhinos in 2013, despite the clampdown on this wildlife crime by the authorities. Poaching trends and the level of sophistication in the killing of rhino, backed by enormous resources, were very alarming in 2014, where 1,215 rhinos were killed. The following year of 2015, however, South Africa experienced a slight decrease of 1,175 rhinos killed relative to the year before. This was the first time South Africa recorded a decrease in rhino poaching levels since 2007. The poaching levels, however, seem to be on a downward trajectory, if the statistics to date is anything to go by. And of course, the minister was announcing some of the statistics over the weekend. Yeah, that we are experiencing decline relative to last year at this period. So we are doing something in keeping this rhino poaching. Rhino poaching is the worst environmental crime that the county has ever witnessed. Various security measures have been introduced by relevant authorities and stakeholders to curb rhino poaching. However, it will seem that the biggest stumbling block for all kinds of anti-rhino poaching strategies are the immense and ever-increasing rate at which the animals are poached, which makes counter-insurgent measures very difficult to establish. Perhaps as lawmakers, we should consider introducing legislation to make it mandatory for our courts to impose minimum sentences of, for an example, at least 15 years for those found guilty of this heinous crime, which could possibly serve as a deterrent for would-be poachers. It is about time that we advocate for the treatment of this crime as high priority crime, and our courts should join the nation in condemning this crime by imposing peace sentences. It is in this context, ladies and gentlemen, that the Portfolio Committee decided to convene this colloquium to highlight the question of rhino poaching as one of the many issues to be discussed at the 17th meeting of the Conference of the Parties to the CITES, which our country, South Africa, will be hosting from the 24th of September to the 5th of October in Johannesburg. And part of the purpose of this colloquium is also to assess our state of readiness in hosting this auspicious global occasion. Under the theme, Challenges, Successes and Pitfalls in Our Existing Rhino Poaching Strategies, a panel of experts will help us to examine and interrogate the issues in rhino conservation in the face of ongoing killing of this species throughout the length and breadth of our country. The interactive nature of the colloquium will facilitate for members and invited guests to robustly, we hope, engage in the presentation. Our expectations are that the discussions and the relevant resolutions emanating from this gathering will bolster our anti-rhino poaching strategies in order for these strategies to result in material decreases in rhino mortality on the ground. I therefore, ladies and gentlemen, would like to take this opportunity to welcome you to this important gathering. We have prepared a program according to which we are going to conduct our business this morning and afternoon. And in terms of the program, we are on the first item where we'll be receiving an address from the minister. May I therefore take this opportunity to invite the Honorable Minister of Environmental Affairs Department, Honorable Edna Mewa, to address us on the state of readiness the issues for and the expectation for the COP presenting to the site that we will be hosting. If I may invite the minister to come to the podium to address us, can we give a round of applause?
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair of the Portfolio Committee, Honourable MEC from the Northern Cape Province, who is here with us, and thanks for joining us. Our DG and team, the collective from SANPARC, all these ladies and gentlemen who have been called to come and make presentations here today, but also those who are our guests. All of you, ladies and gentlemen, let me also recognize our members of the Portfolio Committee, not only you, Chair. Thank you very much indeed for inviting us to be part of this meeting, and or inviting them. Because I'm a member of the Portfolio Committee. So we are here also as a department, accompanied by our public entity, which is SANPARC, to engage on this very important discussion. And I think it is important also to say, Chair, that with your vision of really getting all of us to engage like this just before, society meeting is very, very much appreciated, because this will help us to firstly deepen our engagement and ensure that at least when we face the world together, we are all at the same wavelength of understanding the issues that some of us may not have been exposed to in the past. But also ensuring that we develop the same understanding or purpose of engaging with the various countries of the world that will be on our shores. First of all, Chair, I just want to, before I get to the main presentation that will be deemed on the screen, just to touch on a few issues in addition to what you elaborated on earlier on. And those issues are around how this issue of rhino poaching has been unfolding. These are just additions to what you said. We have noted that this increase in rhino poaching has actually started around 2008. And that was incidentally the year on which we had put a moratorium on rhino sales of loose ones. Remember the live rhino sales were still going on, but it was on a horn in particular, local sales, because people were always able to trade locally in South Africa. By the way, societies only prohibit international trade. We are making this point so that we link mass process with the fact that we have to go through certain court processes, legal processes, where a number of our rhino operators, farmers, were not quite happy with the fact that we had put this moratorium. We are, however, post-court processes in continuing to engage with them, but also looking at mechanisms as how to find and resolve that challenge that we were faced with. Second thing that I wanted us to just refer to is the Committee of Inquiry, which you touched a bit on. We thought that it was important that we establish a Committee of Inquiry to engage all South Africans in order to really find out or get input as we got them, of what can be done over and above the matters that we are currently engaged on in fighting this kind of poaching. Meaning that there was nothing that was going to be left out. In other words, we were still going to continue with our program and our fight as we had it in all its pillars, but we thought that it's important to find out, could there be a possibility of trading on a rhino horn? And the horn we were also thinking about here is the tons and tons of the stockpiles that we have. And of course, we needed some scientific information, knowledge of what this would entail, the do's and don'ts, who would be the market, if everyone has to be such a market, what could be the behavior, what about our own communities out there. So the Temple of Reverence, amongst others, were carrying on these issues. The Committee of Inquiry has since reported, we have tabled that report to Cabinet, and it has been quite evident that we now know that there are certain things that we have to do even before there could be, and things emphasizing there could be, a process to approach scientists to ask for allowing South Africa to trade on the rhino horn. Remembering also that South Africa is the only country in the world that has got the highest number of rhino, second would be Namibia, with just under 30,000 of the rhino. We are around over the 20,000 thereabouts. So we thought it's important that we do that work that the Committee of Inquiry and subsequently Cabinet has agreed to, that must be done. Amongst others is the really dedicated crime prevention strategy. That has to be formulated in South Africa and implemented so that you also see its successes. Why am I mentioning this particular one, Chair? Because in our presentation we're also going to be talking to that strategy a bit, and so that you can see how far we have gone in implementing some of those recommendations and therefore final cabinet decisions in as far as it concerns things that we're lacking behind, that were pointed out at by the Committee of Inquiry. That's national crime prevention strategy on wildlife management, and it's also the issue of ensuring that we make our communities become part and parcel of this whole business, if you like, of sustainable development and natural utilization of our natural resources by our communities, and therefore them not becoming a part of those who are doing them into this illegality. And then of course, understanding the international world, who the market and so forth, that work still has to be done. We will talk to that matter and those matters in, as we would today be tabling the outcome of our Rhino Lab in brief, in summary. Because the Rhino Lab table discussion also indicates how we are going to be talking to those issues. These three things are important, especially because as we discuss the state of readiness, South Africa is also intending to inform the world of these are the initiatives that we're taking in order to fight the search of rhino poaching. Currently, we are acting under the integrated strategic management approach that has been adopted by Cabinet. And we will talk to that, and I think Dr. Sam Pereira will speak to some of the issues later on that talks to the bio management of these resources. Having said that, Chair, I'm not sure if today I must be a technical person and view this presentation, or should I ask, I think the latter request, maybe I should ask somebody to lead us in this discussion via Carol, who will then take us through this whole presentation, including the other two matters that I said to earlier on. But I must say that I'm not sure if there are issues about Mozambique here. They are not in the latter presentation. I'll have to deal with those issues of international collaboration, including our actions with Mozambique. If they are not, I know they will be there, but not quite in detail. But we may talk to some other issues in the ensuing discussion. Later. thank you very much for watching.
Thank you very much, Honorable Minister. I think it's in order that we allow the nominated officials to proceed with the detailed presentation. We will then go down and see that file so that we're able to see what is going to be happening on the screen. You can do that presentation from where you're seated. You don't have to come here. Okay. Got you.
Thank you to honourable members, Minister. I'm just trying to move closer to a mic. Thank you for the opportunity. We would like to share with the portfolio committee and other organisations present here this morning information relating to South Africa's readiness to host the 17th Conference of Parties Societies, proposal submitted by South Africa for consideration by the COP, key proposals submitted by other CITES parties. It's about 62 proposals, so I will not go into all of them. I try to extract the most important ones for South Africa. And then, of course, sharing some events that South Africa will be hosting as a government. And hopefully we will see the portfolio committee members at those study events and get you involved in participating in them. And then also key working documents that will be discussed. Discussions at the COP are basically centered around proposals, which looks at listed species and different dependencies, and then also working documents that end up in the resolution or decision that will be implemented by the parties. In terms of background, just quickly, South Africa ratified the convention already in 1975, so we're one of the first parties to the convention, and there's currently 183 signatories, countries that are party to the convention. Tonga joined just a week or two ago. We are hosting the COP and it's taking place at the Santa Convention Center on the 24th of September until the 5th of October. And as Minister has mentioned, it's important to know that CITES aims to regulate international trade in CITES-listed species to ensure that the trade remains sustainable and is not detrimental to the survival of the species in the wild. So the COP takes place every 3 years. And at these meetings, we review the implementation of the convention, decide on listings of species in the facilities, and then implementation takes place continuously after that. These are 120 working documents to be discussed, including a range of 62 proposals that will be discussed. And then just to note that species are categorized in three appendices, Appendix 1, 2, and 3. The COP does not decide on Appendix 3 listings. That is for a country to decide to leverage species to improve the regulation and monitoring of international trade. The two key appendices that will be discussed is Appendix 1, in which commercial trade is not allowed, and trade is only authorized in exceptional circumstances, and Appendix 2, in which commercial trade is allowed, but of course regulated through a permitting system, and countries must ensure that that trade is not detrimental to the survival of the species in the wild. In terms of our trade readiness to host a COP, in terms of logistics, we have a local organizing committee that was already working from 2015. They are responsible for all logistical and security arrangements relating to the COP, and it's a point where all these issues are discussed and readiness is assessed. I've got a list there of all the department entities that's involved in this local organizing committee. Important to note that, of course, it's African police service is involved in terms of the security arrangements. Then we're working with our host city, it's the city of Johannesburg, and they appointed a professional conference organizer that is also assisting us in terms of ensuring that adequate staffing, the accreditation of the participants. We want to deliver a green COP, so we're going to try and minimize the use of paper at this COP, especially through that we are developing an app that will be used rather than paper to access documents, organize your schedule, keep participants updated in terms of what is being discussed, etc. And this is the first one for the scientists to appeal that this will happen. It's never been done before, so a lot of pressure on us to deliver the first initiative in this regard. And then also we have tours, coordinated tours. We're looking at there's a sponsored delegates program where the scientist secretariat has gone through a process to collect funds to sponsor participants from developing countries. And what we are looking at is where we can offer tours to those sponsored delegates so that they can see some of South Africa during the stay here, but there will also be a board other tours made available for participants to look at that covers the whole of South Africa, because we'd like to use the opportunity to showcase South Africa and our rich biodiversity. We're also preparing for an opening and closing ceremony and a host and reception. Then, of course, practical arrangements like microphone management systems, voting systems, etc. Are all being put in place. We also have service providers assisting us in terms of various other issues like the development of the logo for the CFP. We're doing radio deployments, and you might have heard some radio ads relating to biodiversity and conservation in general, but also lately promoting the COP, informing people that it's taking place, inviting them to come to the exhibition space that we will be having, where there will also be an interactive zone where people can come and listen to some key issues to be discussed around conservation. There's also been a digital and social media campaign. We have a website that you can see going visit with information related to the COP. Looking at branding the COP, and I'll speak to that now. And then, as I mentioned, the science exhibition space, we've got 29 NGOs that is board space. The exhibition space is sold out completely, and there's a waiting list. We have South African Pavilion, which will be South African government departments and entities, and also an African Pavilion, where five organizations and countries are exhibiting. Then we're also promoting sustainability projects that will be showcased at the COP. And we're working on a legacy program. The legacy program is focused on the youth conservation program. We've identified the need to focus specific actions around youth and youth involvement in conservation. This is just some of the branding that we rolled out on Nippon Leaf Cars, another measure to promote the Green COP. And at the Gautrain station and at the airport, we will have signage to guide people to see, to direct them to the Gautrain and then the venue for the meeting. Then we also had this digital campaign around conservation is our responsibility, be the difference, that integrates fauna and flora elements with human elements to show interconnectedness between us and nature and the need to look after natural resources. Then in terms of the content matters, we had an interdepartmental substance committee that was appointed to develop the South African position side and give guidance in this regard. They've also been working since 2015. We had two stakeholder engagements where we invited stakeholders to submit us with their comments on the documents to be discussed, and that was considered in the development of the position paper. There was two site engagements as the sub-region. We met to develop a common position on some key issues, and then there was an Africa preparatory meeting that took place in August as well. In terms of the proposals that I mentioned, there's about 62 days, there's just a division there that you can see in terms of all the different taxonomic groups are covered. So although elephant and rhino and lion seems to steal the spotlight, a variety of other species are actually covered in terms of discussions. The key proposals from South Africa, we submitted three proposals, one on the Red Mountain Zebra, we downloaded from Appendix 1 to Appendix 2. We've, at South Africa, we've had some great conservation successes in terms of bringing the species back from a number between 50 and 80 to just about 5,000 now. And of course, the private sector played a significant role in terms of that as well, making land available for Red Mountain Zebra. Then wild ginger, it's not currently listed, we prefer to include it in Appendix 2 as a species that's used for medicinal purposes, and we've noticed, based on work that Sandy commissioned, we noticed that there's an influx of these plants from neighboring states, so we are preparing to list the species for those countries that are affected. And then pangolin, you might have heard that pangolin is also affected by illegal wildlife trade. And there's been a process with all pangolin range sites to discuss a possible listing in Appendix 1 and start application support of listing its indigenous species on Appendix 1. Sandy then also assisted in terms of the Cape Mountain Zebra. You need to put in place a precautionary measure, and that we will do in terms of a quota that will be directly harvested in terms of the number of animals that can be removed. provided some modeling that we will be making available in the form of the information document to the ITS participants. And this is the graph that sort of summarizes how we will be managing offtake. So you can see on the y-axis the initial population size, and then at the bottom the offtake or harvesting numbers, and you can use this as a means to determine what is the number of offtake that will remain sustainable. The other proposals not submitted by South Africa but have been forwarded to South Africa is a proposal on the African line to list all populations of line on Appendix 1. Unfortunately, there's been a decline at the global scale, but that is, of course, similar for all land states. So in terms of the proposals submitted, you will see that there's a decline of more than 60% between 1993 and 2014, and that has been observed in most populations except for Botswana, Namibia, Africa, Zimbabwe, and India. In Botswana, Namibia, South Africa, and Zimbabwe, the lion populations have increased 5% over the last 21 years. In South Africa, we have over 3,000 wild lions, of which 67% are wild predators within our protected area system. So what I would like to say at this point in time, in terms of living on the site of the species, there are specific criteria that must be met, especially for Appendix 1 listed species. Some biological criteria must be met for species to be included in Appendix 1. It's quite technical, so I'm not going to go into detail. But from South Africa's side, the concern is that our populations do not meet the criteria to be included in Appendix 1. As you can see, our populations are stable and growing, and therefore there's some challenges in terms of supporting this proposal, considering the fact that our populations are doing well. We do recognize that other countries do have some challenges, but we are concerned that the main threat should be addressed and focused on, and that includes habitat loss, human-wildlife conflict and prey-based depletion. And if those key issues are not addressed, of course, at national and regional level, the Appendix 1 listing will not assist the conservation of the species. Then, of course, there was a submission by Swaziland to list, to change the annotation to the Appendix 2 listing for southern white rhino. They would like to sell rhino horn accumulated from natural depths. And then also the government stockpile is about 350 kilograms and then 20 kilograms per annum through various retailers, and they would like to use those resources towards the conservation of their population. In terms of elephants, there are three proposals that will be considered by the CFP, two from, one from Namibia, another one from Zimbabwe and Namibia, and the last one from a number of Eastern, Central and Western African countries. The first two is from Namibia and Zimbabwe to change the annotation to the African elephant listing to enable them to trade if the species is listed on Appendix 2, which means legal acquisition must be confirmed and non-human findings done. That will mean that they will be able to sell ivory, which is currently prohibited in terms of the annotation to the listing. And then, of course, the proposed 16 is to list the populations that are currently in Appendix 2, which is Botswana, Namibia, South Africa, and Zimbabwe's population, back on Appendix 1. As I've mentioned earlier, there are specific criteria that must be met for inclusion in Appendix 1, which relates to decline, predicted decline, etc. And for those four countries that criteria is not met, our populations are doing well, and they are increasing, so that will be the discussion at the COP. Then other bird proposals that we thought is important, the peregrine falcon, so Africa is an state for the falcon, and Canada proposed it should be downloaded from Appendix 1 to Appendix 2. It's a migratory species that the populations are doing very well, and the species that are kind of the specimens currently in trade are mostly from captive breeding facilities. So the proposal is straightforward. Then African grey parrot is an important proposal for the African continent. It's to list the species in Appendix 1, so transferring from Appendix 2 to Appendix 1. So Africa is not a range state, but we have significant captive populations. So approximately 1,600 breeding facilities and about 30,000 breeding pairs. So just through captive breeding, we produce about 35,000 specimens that we trade in internationally and globally per annum. So although we're not a range state, we have these captive populations and we are managing So I think one of our concerns is there are a lot of management interventions required in running space to assist them to manage their resource better. If the species is listed on Appendix 1, all benefits associated with international flights will come to countries that are actually captive, involved in captive breeding. And we have some concerns that those benefits don't accrue to running space. So that will be also an important proposal that we will be discussing at the COB. Then marine proposals, that's what I will highlight. At the last COP, the first sharks were listed on the site of the Pedaces. The hammerhead, the oceanic white tip, and another one that I can't remember now. And so these are three additional marine species that they are proposing for listing. It's the silky shark, the pressure shark, and the devil rays. Then there's also a number of rosewood proposals. As you know, timber trade is also an important trade, international trade for range set. It's a high value species or high value timber. So there are proposals to include additional species of rosewood, the Alberta species, on the site of Pedaces. Although South Africa is a range set for some of these species, our trees unfortunately don't grow to the extent where we can harvest timber from them. They're more smaller due to climatic reasons. Then in terms of the side events, we have 13 side events registered, ranging from issues that you will hear about in terms of anti-poaching operations, use of technology in anti-poaching, but we also want to bring in the focus about the importance of science in decision-making. The Ice Scientific Authority will also have a side event. We will also reflect on the Committee of Inquiry process, then a biodiversity lab that you will hear about soon, also the Environmental Management Inspectorate. An important side event for us is, of course, the reflecting on the cooperation between South Africa and Mozambique that we will be jointly having with Mozambique to showcase how we've been working with them intersectionally to address a lot of the issues around rhino poaching and illegal trade in rhino horn. Then we're also going to have a side event on the youth conservation program that I spoke about. This forms part of our legacy program for this ICCOP. We're going to get launching a rhino conservation range state action plan. Over the last 3 years, we've been working with all rhino range states to develop an action plan that will ensure that we have collective action to address issues around rhino conservation and illegal trade in rhino horn. And then also SACAT conservation actions, our People of Last program, and the Jeff UNEP rhino program that we have. Just quickly, the key working documents. There's a long list of documents, so I'd like to just summarize or list the most important ones, which range from establishment of rural communities committees to give the communities a bigger voice in terms of discussions at the COP, to capacity building, and I included a graph there of the work that's been done intersectionally around capacity building, and I think of concern is the fact that developing countries seriously lack in terms of capacity building interventions for scientists. And as you know, if you are not capacitated to implement the convention properly, the value sometimes gets lost. So we would like, as South Africa, just to focus on this a little bit at the COP to ensure that there's more funds allocated towards capacity building to build countries' ability to implement this convention properly. Of course, livelihood issues, matters relating to demand reduction and further work to be done in terms of demand reduction. And then empowering the next generation, which relates to youth issues, so our youth conservation program will also be captured in terms of that specific item. Then in terms of interpretation and implementation issues, there's issues around national laws. As you know, each individual country has put in place national laws to implement the convention, and there's different categories that they are classified under. And therefore, there's always a reporting in terms of how far parties are in terms of implementation. And of course, if they do not do that in a timely manner, they can be repercussions for those services. Enforcement matters that also lead to illegal international trade in wildlife. So there's quite a number of documents on enforcement and issues around legal international trade that include, for example, issues around corruption and various other issues. Identification of elephant and mammoth ivory. I don't know if you're aware, but mammoth ivory trade has increased in the past, and there's concerns relating to the identification. There are ways and means to identify the, or separate the one from the other in terms of identification, and more work will be done in terms of that. Hunting trophies, that actually submitted a government on hunting trophies as of the EU, and we're working towards finding a common revised version before the COP. And stock and stockpile management, which is always an issue for parties because we have allocated resources to manage stockpiles efficiently, and they will be urged to look at that as well. And on elephants, there's a number of documents on elephants. including the report on the monitoring of illegal killing of elephants and the elephant trade information system, issues around ivory stockpiles, guidelines for management or destruction, closure of domestic ivory markets and trading live elephants. There's also a document submitted by South Africa relating to international trade in sky cat species, encephalitis species, and a document on pangolins, and then some key three species for Africa that will be discussed at the meeting. There's also an agenda item on the rhino, looking at the, all the work that's been done in the intercessional period from the last COP up to now, and there's also a proposed draft decision going forward relating to the implementation of the rhino task force decision, and that we should continue to review poaching and trafficking chains to ensure that our measures remain effective. I think as South Africa, we've continued to revise our interventions and ensure that we adapt as emerging issues come about. And then there's a document on implementation of high strategic vision that is of interest, I think, where it shows that 63% of sites with Renix 1 listed species are classified in the threatened category, and of that 44% are still experiencing population decline. So I think it's important to note that just letting the species on Appendix 1 doesn't necessarily save it, so you need to have other conservation measures in place as well. So the purpose of this document is to look at what is still happening that causes this decline in these species and what additional conservation measures are needed. And then, of course, the document on a decision-making mechanism for a program of trade in ivory. That is something that's coming from COP 14 that was supposed to be resolved at the last COP, but is still not finalized. Thank you. That's on the proposal. Minister, we just would like to add to this the Rhino Lab outcome, but Minister said if that's fine. So.
Yeah, I think we can do that. Who's going to do it? Or she's going to do that. All right, yeah. Proceed. Rhino Lab, how long are you going to take?
Less than 5 minutes. I'm going to be very quick.
Okay. All right, I'll do that, but also don't compromise the quality of the information that you're sharing with us. Okay?
Thanks, Jeff. Thank you for the opportunity. So as Minister said, we subjected the cabinet decisions that emanated from the Committee of Inquiry process to a Rhino Lab process. And this slide just shows we had an overall biodiversity lab process where we looked at the, how we're going to implement a biodiversity economy strategy moving forward. And so the Rhino Conservation Lab is one of the pillars of the overall biodiversity lab that we focus on those cabinet decisions from the This is the background slide in terms of what we've been doing today and the interventions today. It was then subjected to the lab methodology where we had a number of participants, I think 14 total, and this included various government departments that are affected by this matter. It included NGOs and some key experts that we've identified to assist us in terms of identifying actions to be taken. So we took place over a 3 week period where people have been working off-site until late in the day, and they looked at developing 3 feet plans, which is detailed implementation plans, also identifying the budget needed to realize those initiatives developed. So just to remind the portfolio committee, the cabinet approved recommendations coming from the Committee of Inquiry process at 5 different pillars. The first was security in terms of anti-poaching and anti-trafficking, community empowerment, demand management, responsive legislation, and management of rhino populations. So there were recommendations relating to each of those pillars that they were best subjected to the Rhino Lab project, and the lab developed an aspiration, which reads as follows: a robust integrated approach by all stakeholders to secure a meta population of rhino in Africa through effective reduction in the number of rhino killed through poaching by 11.1%, resulting in the increase in the population at 20% per annum through 2020. That will allow us to meet our target as in the biodiversity management plan. To achieve that, we identified a total of 44 initiatives that's been developed by the lab. For each of those initiatives, there's a 3-week plan. So underneath these, the summary, There are detailed plans with actions, and the responsible departments and the individuals are identified with specific timelines and budgets. So in terms of law enforcement, it's split into two. Anti-poaching, which is more focused on your anti-poaching units and your ability to respond on the ground. And that is the key initiative is to improve the standardization of best practices, to localize the footprint in the park, to ensure that there's more focus on the perimeter protection. It also includes reactive elements in terms of the providers that require further attention in terms of increasing their capabilities in terms of APUs, and then also proactive elements in terms of increasing our ability in terms of intelligence, transnational cooperation, and the use of technology. There's a portfolio committee, probably know that coming from the committee of inquiry process, the South African Police Service developed a national integrated strategy for wildlife trafficking, to address wildlife trafficking. This is not only focused on the rhino, it's to address all wildlife trafficking issues that we have in South Africa. And that that strategy that was developed by staff in collaboration with a number of key security cluster departments as well as the department was also sort of unpacked through the lab process, which is now a detailed implementation plan. And it's focused on three specific pillars, in terms of prosecution, increasing collaboration to ensure prosecution, especially in terms of transnational organized crime, detection capability, and collaboration. So that was in fact the detail. In terms of community engagement, we're looking at enhancing the community ambassador program that we do have, increasing the number of people involved in that and rolling that out. Also looking at taking stock of all the economic empowerment activities in communities that stand in place. There are various initiatives implemented by departments, there are expanded public works programs, there's the management authorities are implementing stuff, NGOs are implementing projects, so we want to consolidate all of that, look at best practice, look at successful initiatives, and then build from there so that we make important decisions going forward in terms of how we can assist in terms of economic development. And then also looking at broader restorative justice program with SAFs. There's a concern in terms of the enforcement element and how do we ensure that SAFs are seen as more than an enforcer, but also someone they can work with, and then launching a community empowerment plan. In terms of demand reduction, the need for peer-reviewed research was identified, and there's some key areas of research that we'll be focusing on, including the measuring, getting a sense of how successful the demand reduction initiatives are, what are the impacts of large-scale destructions in terms of messaging that we send out, and then also looking at the potential of alternative options to address the demand for rhino horn, and looking at what is feasible in that regard. And then a key issue of demand for management that came out was the targeted messaging. The concern about messaging associated with communication campaigns. For example, what are we telling people if we say so many rhinos have died, that the price is so high and the numbers are low? It's almost like you're stimulating the demand for a scarce resource. And there's some advice given in terms of we must look at it's or improve communication so that you don't create false perceptions relating to the value of the war and leading to speculative stockpiling, etc. Then responsive legislation, this is looking specifically at stock formation. The private sector has got a specific initiative here to look at consolidating stockpiles into central stock piling facilities that will improve monitoring, auditing, and security issues. We're also looking at the amendment of the national legislation to provide for effective regulation of national trade in rhino horn, depending on what the outcome would be of the current litigation that's ongoing. Issues around providing financial security incentives for rhino conservation, and of course one of the key issues that were highlighted is the challenges relating to number of permits required involving rhino specific activities, and looking how we can align or consolidate legislation related to these activities, authorizing these activities. And one that always is mentioned is the electronic printing system and how we will roll that out with some added features like biometrics, etc. And I left the management of minor populations for last. Dr. Ferrara will inform the committee how important management of minor populations are, because if you manage them well, we will ensure the conservation of the species into the future. And then we're going to look at guidelines for the different land use options or the management options involving rhino. What is very important is a key one is securing and growing rhino, key rhino populations and securing funding for those key populations. If we have them and we secure them, then we know that we will have rhino into the future. I think it also improving best practice in terms of how the mechanisms for sharing the information relating to best practice among different stakeholders and improving studies reporting through the existing practice that we have. And we also identified 10 quick wins that we can implement over the next 12 months. Also third pillar, and they are reflected there in terms of enforcement, its qualifications and the sorting equipment for the APUs, in terms of community engagement, is to recruit and deploy community facilitators in the identified hotspot, and also rolling out the community ambassador or community ranger program. Demand management, looking at expanding the investigation in terms of the potential alternative options to get demand. And then management of rhino populations, wants to secure funding to protect those key rhino populations that I referred to, and improve the use of the permitting system that we have at the moment. And then responsive legislation, the focus will be on implementation of rhino stockpiles. It's from a private sector initiative point of view, as government already has the system in place, and looking at measures to effectively regulate domestic trade in rhino. And there will be a process to track achievements through a delivery unit, the tracking system that we need to develop, the electronic tracking system, so the information will go into the electronic tracking system so that we can report on a regular basis in some of the achievements. So we just see the rhino lab as a turning point in terms of increasing further the levels of collaboration. We are very happy with the ownership from the South African Police Service. We are collaborating with them. They're really owning this new strategy that they've developed and are fully committed to implement that. And of course, we have detailed and costed implementation plan, and we do believe that with this highly ambitious initiative, we can further secure our own population into the future. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the presentation. I would then, Honourable Minister, with your presentation. Is there one more?
Yes, behind me, the standard.
On the
chair.
Okay.
Dr. Ferreira. And Mr.
Okay.
The rhino, the next topic.
Yeah, on the management and conservation of rhino populations. All right, Dr. Saira, the floor is yours. I hope colleagues are taking notes, and all our invited guests. In this colloquium, we're going to allow our guests. It's not going to be a normal parliamentary committee meeting where only the members ask questions. So the guests are also will be allowed to engage with the presentations. So you can take note once our colleagues from the department are going through the presentation. Are you ready? Okay, floor is yours.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you, Honourable Chairperson, and Honourable Members and Minister, and all other colleagues around. It is a privilege to share with you some of the challenges around biological management. And in the biodiversity lab, we define the problem as very simple. Rhinos are dying too fast and they're breeding too slow. And I think that's the crux of what biological management of South Africa has done for a very long time. So I'm going to take you a little bit through the state-owned land challenges. There's going to be some repetitions on some of the things that you've heard. Just on a note, most of these are pictures, but the printout does have notes associated with every one of the slides, so it makes it a bit easier for people to keep record of what might come. To remind you that we are the downtown rhino of the world, and I've just summarized here, if you look at the black rhinos, the top one, The grey areas, different shades of grey areas are actually well, on state land. And obviously when you look at what happens in white rhino, there's a large fraction of that, more than 60% of the world's rhinos are on state land. I think Angus will talk a little bit later on private land. But the one other point I want to point out on the slide is, I look at the black rhino one, and you'll see there's a little figure called 0.5%. That is the total ownership of rhinos currently in communities, in traditional people. So there's enormous opportunities for us to assist people and to help them with us achieving some of the rhino things. Anyway, this is based on the records that, that the African rhino specialist has delivered in the end of February earlier this year, I think. But it's this particular element that, of course, got all of us here today, and that is this increasing rising of rhino carcasses that we discovered. We've had this onslaught since 2008, as the minister highlighted a bit earlier, at 2015 we did have some successes in turning the tide, and hopefully we can keep on turning the tide by the end of this year. But I want to get back to the challenges that were identified in the rhino lab, was one of the things that Sia referred to earlier. We have many ways in which you can see the cat. We've got rhino that can live in small areas, or they can live in very large areas, and they provide different constraints and opportunities. If rhinos are living in a small area, the management intent is very high. The picture that you see there is actually on one of the private ownership, and you can see in the back there, there's those little, they look like black dots, like fire lying around there. That's like a feeding spot where they feed rhinos and so forth. Of course, if you look at our objectives, we want to maximize growth of rhinos in the short term. We really want to make sure rhinos are around for the long term. But on top of that, we want to get the best opportunities for our people to benefit from rhinos. And I think those are the critical things. And when you're working across different sizes of landscapes, you have different opportunities, but you also have different challenges. And I think that's the reality. Don't put all our eggs in the same basket. We need to think a little bit about how we do that. Okay. So if I'm going to show you some examples. Angus will talk quite a bit about this. The present private ownership are very much based on the principle of a species. If a species stays, stays. And in a survey I think that they did last year, if things stay as they are, there will be various things that people will do with their rhinos. So some people will keep their rhinos, some people will get rid of their rhinos. And yes, part of the reason is it costs a lot of money for a private guy to keep rhinos on his property. I'm sure Angus can highlight that. But what it does show you is that there's some volatility in this particular land use, which may put different kind of risks, but also give different kind of opportunities for you in the short term. That's important. So I'll leave that Angus later. In our protected areas, we have used basically a variety of approaches. We use different zones that allow us to manage our vulnerabilities very differently. Doesn't mean one zone is better than the other one. It just means you're going to get pick up your bum if you get there in a different way, if you're trying to come do something to arrive. The important thing is we make use of technology. So that little graph that you see on the right-hand side tells us something about what technology can do for us. Sometimes technology can do very good things for us, other times it can't. Effectively, if you're at the scale of a place like Kruger, putting technology onto a rhino may not bring as much benefit to you as, for instance, making use of intelligence. But that may be very different when I'm working in a small reserve. And I think those are opportunities and the realizations that we have to take. What were the results of this whole thing? If you look at this slide, I summarized this from stuff that I got from Jutta and from Nicholas. And I think the important thing is across the typical measures, the number of people trying to enter the park increased between the year-to-year comparison between 2015 and 2016. But the number of people arrested also increased, and the number of firearms that we see increased. And yes, we've got this wonderful result that carcasses are busy decreasing about 18% in the first half of the year compared to the first half of 2015. And I actually did a calculation and said, well, what fraction of the population, so in other words, you can just simply say, well, okay, the carcasses are declining because we're running out of rhinos. So if you actually work out and say, what fraction of the live rhinos were actually poached, that gives you a better indication. So the real decline
is actually a 23% decrease in poaching rate. I think that is incredible given the onslaught that the guys have experienced in Kruger. So good on the Rangers for what they've achieved. When I go to some of the provinces, and I've made use here of the data that Cedric and his team provided for me, we can see that some of the successes that we get in places like Kruger now may create challenges for other places in the provinces. So here's an example where you basically see completely the opposite. You've seen an increase in activities, but we've had an increase in the carcasses and all the other things that are taking place. And in fact, the real poaching rate has even gone higher given the number of rhinos sitting out there. So your successes in one part of the country may lead to us having challenges in other parts of the country. So this idea that we actually got to be much more wider in how we implement things is a very important concept. Nonetheless, this is probably one of the most important slides for Nicholas's rangers on the ground, and I think for your rangers also sending on ground. When you look at the difference between the number of poaching activities that we record per day, which is the top graph, both in Kruger and the top line, sorry, and then the top graph is Kruger and the bottom graph is KZN. That difference between that and the bottom line, which is the number of rhinos poached, they tell us the guys is what I call the ranger effect. There may be lots of people trying to get into the park, but not all of them get a rhino. And I think that's a very important measure. So up to now, we have managed to keep that difference between people trying to get into the park and the actual number of the success of the poaching event quite low. I think this is due to the various activities that happen in the various parks, what the rangers are doing inside parks. So this is one element. But there's another element. This is the biological management element side of things. And we've been doing this for some time. This is a black rhino that has been shifted, I think, sadly, from one of your parks. Hopefully with the assistance of the WWF participation in the Black Rhino Rain Extension Project. Yes, there's another additional other things that we do around parks, like the KZN Rhino Ambassador Program, and yes, the use of proactive intelligence and so forth. In Kruger National Park, we've also been moving rhinos for quite some time. In fact, we introduced rhinos there in 1961, I think. The first white rhinos got to Kruger from KZN, 351. We started moving rhinos out of Kruger from 1990 already, but you'll notice from roughly about 2008 onwards, we had quite an aggressive rhino removal. This was part of the developing at that stage integrated plan, which eventually got approved by Cabinet in 2014, I'm correct. And you'll notice also, particularly 2014, we did some experimental work where we translocated rhinos inside Kruger, with all this internal translocation from places where they've got different challenges and so forth. So one of the questions we should ask, okay, so did this biological management do something for us? Yes, some of these animals that being transported to go to other places do form part of hunting taxes. And that, of course, generates additional income, et cetera, and opportunities for people. And those of you that have done some farming will realize that you don't necessarily need a lot of bulls to deal with a lot of cows. One bull can do the same job than the 10 cows and what 10 bulls might be doing. So those are some of the sort of principles that actually drive these things and so forth. I know that there's some girls smiling in the room. I'm not sure why they're smiling. But the reality is we should be asking, and we've done a little analysis on the Kruger case, and we said, what would have been the number of rhinos if we left those rhinos that we moved out of Kruger in Kruger over the period of the poaching onslaught compared to if the ones actually happened when we moved them? So that top graph shows you the little broken line at the bottom and what the number of rhinos would have been if I left those 900-odd rhinos that we moved in Kruger. The top one is actually what those 900 rhinos really realized for us. In effect, by the end of 2015, we managed through biological management to offset nearly 25% of the poaching losses that we experienced in Kruger. And I think that's a very important thing. We might have lost 826 rhinos in Kruger in 2015, but because of the offset, we only lost, as real terms, 591. And that's an important element, you know, yes, working together, not just in protecting miners, but also in generating ways that we can free miners. So that's a very important thing for us. It's costly. We summarize you here that the kind of things happens in Sandbox, and I'm sure Cedric can give you similar kind of things. Yes, we normally focus on the financial side. You'll see those bars there up and down, and in Kruger National Park, where we're spending most of our money. But the costs are not just financial. The costs are also a lot of hidden costs. A range of well-being, and Nicholas will talk a little bit about that. Certainly, folks are families too. Remember, they are the families as well, just like rangers are the families. The opportunity loss, in some instances, our rangers are spending less than 5% of their time on other conservation tasks. And then infrastructure that comes with you. I think something which I will end up a bit later, I think Tia already referred to it, and this is the media framing. And I will show you a little bit of thing later. A lot of our discourse that we are talking, the language that we're using, are putting messages across that may actually constrain and achieving this. So those are some of the hidden costs. So with all this activity, what has happened to our rhino populations? In KZN, we've essentially maintained the rhinos over an extended nearly more than 10 years. But when you look at the targets that the guys are specified in there, out of the 5 targets that have measures, only 1 were achieved. So this poaching is really putting brakes on what we want to achieve for our rhinos. And so I think much of this is very dependent on successes you have somewhere else that now diverts guys come and try their things in other places and so forth. If you look at the rhinos that are in national parks, we've got 3 subspecies that we deal with. And one of them we're doing very well. I think we've already reached the targets we're supposed to have by 2020. But when we look at the southern white rhino, which is a lot of rhinos and the biggest lot, we basically managed to maintain their population. We actually need 3% growth per annum to reach South Africa's targets by 2020 for those ones. The South Central black rhino, the one that lives in Kruger, is the one that's really the biggest worry for us. We've had a substantial decline in those guys over the last 5 years. And we have been 15% growth over the next year, bunch of years, to 2020 to reach our targets, which is not possible because black rhino has to complete this one. So there's some very interesting challenges that we need to deal with. Nonetheless, it boils down to an extremely simple measure for Nicholas and his rangers. In Kruger National Park, if you get the number of rhinos poached per day down to 1.35 a day, you will have a 3% increase over the next 3 years, 3 or 4 years. But that's an easy target to achieve, I think, for the work to. But having said that, we show you what we...
Can I say something? I think that it's important to explain whether this, what you're talking about the population growth, especially in a part of the concern central black line, is that measured particularly to poaching? Because I think it's important to talk to that point.
So black rhino, thank you, Minister, it's a very important question. The black rhino challenge in Kruger has got a multiple set of challenges. There's roughly about between 300 and 400 odd black rhinos, definitely, that we know about in Kruger. That sounds like a lot. But when you put 300 to 400 of those in the flesh size of Israel, there's a fairly good chance that the cow might be walking around in one part of the park and be ready to be mated, but the bull is on the other side of the park. You know, so they don't get those mating opportunities. And this is exactly where biological management can help you. You can shift rhinos and make sure that the bulls and cows get to each other, etc. So poaching is part of the challenge, but the other thing is we have got a small population. Even if I lose just 2 or 3 rhinos, it's a really big impact on that small population. And I think that's the challenge. So we have initiated a specific targeted project in collaboration with WWF, with the assistance from Peabody Foundation, that works specifically on the black rhino, on the black rhino elements in Kruger National Park. And it's got 3 elements: a prioritized security response, a prioritized biological response, and then a dedicated science response. Minister, are you happy with it?
Okay.
Right. If we go, we are a little bit more ambitious than just 3% growth. We actually say, well, what are the things that we should be doing that could help us to do better than what the guys are already doing? And there's a very interesting a work that highlighted the key drivers of protein. And these are these 6 points that you see out there. The top three are largely things that are happening in different places from us. People that trade in these things, they have a long history of trading it, and there's an inelastic demand, and there's high profit potential. The high profit potential is troublesome because that makes it attractive for organized crime to get involved. But when you look at the bottom three, the inadequate law enforcement, the unclear property rights, and the human wildlife conflict disincentives, those are things that are very close to our home and to our heart. And certainly came out in the discussions what have took place in the Rhino lab. So if I go back to this little sanity graph, you know, the rainbow effect, it actually tells us something. If I want to decrease the poacher activities, I need to do what we have said for a long time, clean the park from the outside. For that to happen, I really have to focus on the organized crime, and I really have to provide people with alternative opportunities. People can have economic opportunities if they can do work on the outside. Yes, but don't stop doing what you do on the inside. You know, that's very important. So you've got to do these two things. So that essentially is the basis of the ministers, or under the minister's leadership, that cabinet decided on an integrated approach in 2014. And these were the four pillars. We are summarizing that way. They may not slightly be exactly the way that the minister originally had it aligned, but I hope it captures the picture that he integrated and how we're doing. And yes, we might be thinking big, but to be honest with you, you do things on a small scale when you start right now. That's the sort of thing. So if you think about it, we've talked about the first top two. We've done the anti-poaching stuff, and Nicholas will talk a little bit later more about that. And we've talked about the biological management. I'm going to spend a very short little period, Chairman, if it's okay with you, on what I call the new things, the long-term sustainability elements, and what should be the real game changers for us. So if I quickly look at the long-term sustainability, yes, we've had the dichotomous debate about trade and no trade, and there have been some smart information that people allowed us to use, so we could have an economic model based on what poachers were paid along the supply chain, from level 1 right to level 5, and how that changed over time. And we did that interact with how many rhinos does that economic model want to have poached. And we also have that data. In fact, it was so that we could track roughly what happened in the price structure of the supply chain, and as well as what happened in the rhino structure, the rhino population, over about a 10-year period, was roughly about 80% precision. So that says to us, okay, we've got something that can tell us what may happen in the future. And in fact, what you see up there now, the red are Kruger National Park, and the greens are the provincial reserves or the private reserves. They were roughly about the same rhinos at the time that we ran this model. And if you leave things as they are, rhinos have a very high probability of an increased extinction risk when you get to roughly about 2050. But what is really surprising, if I do more protection, if I go and try and provide horns, if I go and try and do the monkey dusting, even if I do all three of those things, I never get to sustainable and persistent rhinos. The difference comes when we chuck in disrupting organized crime and creating opportunity for people. And I think this is a very key message. You know, we have a debate, or we've had a debate about trade or no trade, it actually doesn't matter. What matters is actually sorting out the organized criminal elements and actually sorting out the opportunities to sit around people. And I think this has been one of the key elements that came out of the committee of inquiry discussion. And I feel proud that our cabinet has made the kind of decision that they have done, recognizing that there's a whole range of things that we have to get right and do that is in our control to make a real big impact. So we're not seeing necessarily the trade as a solution to poaching. We see them as an opportunity once we've got a whole range of other things in place for ourselves. I hope I've summed that up correct, Minister. Right. So if I quickly look at those two things, if you look at the normal supply chain, it looks like this. You have lots of producers, farmers normally, or things like that, and there's somewhere lots of people that must use a particular product. But there's usually only one or two ways now you can get it there. We currently, or we have been up to now, focused a lot on what we do to poachers, which is the producers of the supply chain. And yes, become international, people focus quite a lot on the other end. But if you wanted to disrupt that supply chain, sort out the two things that our models have suggested. Start with the organized crime, and this is exactly the strategy which the Minister and Kia has referred to a bit earlier, that are probably now at the point of being implemented. But the part that I think we need to think very hard a little bit about is how do we create the alternative economic opportunity for people, particularly those people that are living and carrying the brunt of the conservation challenge that we are all living in the part where they often carry the brunt of those ones. And I have taken the liberty to illustrate you some guidance that we may get. Some of you may remember your first year psychology 101, I think, you know, on the basic human needs requirements, you know. And so when you put that hierarchy together, we had a look at some studies that were done around Kruger National Park as an example. And those little gray bars that you see at the bottom is what people identified are the things that they are concerned about. You know, and you'll notice there's quite a lot at the bottom end of the bar. There's quite a lot that's about the basic needs, food, water, housing. That's what they're concerned about. The red are the things that are currently coming from stuff that haven't improved. Now, what I'm not saying is that a protected area should be providing those things. What I'm saying is we as a society as a whole should be thinking quite largely and big about how do we actually capture those things. And yes, there's some opportunities. We can think about examples of where you do programs that talk specifically providing security and food and those sort of things for people, but in a way that cascades into other things. If I do it in a way that also results in a bunch of job opportunity for people, then I've done something wrong. I'm adding to the needs of sitting in a cafe. And one last element, Mr. Chairperson, is none of these things can happen unless you are living in a safe environment. And at the moment, some of our discourse, and perhaps some of your other colleagues here might reflect on it later, actually alienate people. You know, we respond when the criminal walks into the park, we don't respond when the criminal walks into the community. So we say, alright, don't think about changing how you do things. Think about changing the operational area that you have. Don't make your boundaries outside the people are, so they become inclusive in terms of your thinking. So those are the kind of conceptual changes that I think we need to think a little bit about. And Mr. Chairperson, the last point is something that Pierre referred to a bit earlier. In fact, this came out, this is an example that was in the Rhineland outcomes. I just wanted to highlight this. So if you follow the line at the top, often when you look what's written in the media, and this is primarily the medium that is currently where the information being shared, is we tend to tell people how many rhinos there are, how many is dead, how many people were caught, how much money you can get with, etc. But when you look at what people might be hearing, they might actually effectively hear a poaching advertiser. You know? In fact, if we can change this messaging, that bottom line, what you can write or what you can amend in how things can write, we may actually end up with a significantly different set of messages. And I think one of the most important messages is this. The saving of rhinos, or the saving of many species, as the earth I like to put aside these things, may actually be dependent on the saving of people. Minister and the chairperson, that's the story I'd like to end on.
Round of applause, I think. So I guess that concludes the presentations, Minister, from yourself. Okay. Funda will be in the panel discussion after tea. Yeah, it's going to be part of the three panel members who are going to be presenting after tea. You would like to make some concluding remarks before we take Mr. Dallas, one of the ministers.
Just something that I think may need to revisit. Slide number 8, Mr. Pereira, KwaZulu Natal. We have had, I think, this matter will come up also in the presentation by Mr. Bunda. We have had growth in Maturi provinces on Pochi. KZN and Limpopo and Northern Cape. Northern Cape has got small populations and Free State. With the higher one being much more the KZN and followed by Limpopo. Now, if you look at this figure size, and I think we need to contextualize this part. If you look at what this slide is saying, and hoping that you can be implicitly, there's a 44% increase in KwaZulu-Natal. Then they show various other things there. But I just wanted to indicate that the overall increase, the overall status or line of coaching as of where we stand now, is what, 457 nationally as compared to 358 of last year, at Ruga National Park. Nationally inclusive for provinces is 702 of this year versus 396 of last year. Where we had higher 396 nationally, with provinces included, we now have 702. Meaning that if you look at these two figures, even with an increase in the three provinces, in overall, it's still not a highest number or high number. Even if this 44% looks much higher, in general and overall, it's still contained. What then needs to happen, Chair, is that we must now put more serious efforts, not that we are not serious now, but harder, on all provinces and on the three provinces in particular. And Funda will talk to how the strategy is in relation to that part, working with provinces, and we'll add later in the mechanisms to support those provinces and all our provinces. Mindful of the fact that, by the way, even as we do that, we need to look at rank state of SADC in particular, because that's where you find populations. As we curb and close these terminals here, they move to Namibia, they move to Zimbabwe, they move to Botswana. That's already where indications are there that they have started moving to higher numbers in those areas. So closing ranks with the nation, with the ranch states, is also a necessary thing. I just thought I should touch on that particular matter. And then, of course, there's just one last thing, the messaging. Honorable Chair, through you, it's in honorable members of this portfolio committee have been saying, and of course from the media quarters, Minister release rate statistics every day or every week. This is part of the messaging. The more you say to people that, especially at the time, that you are losing rhino today, this number, is the more they say, oh, they are finished. They are being finished because, so let's run quickly and grab before the wires are still there. So this messaging, and the reason why we have said we need to release statistics as part of overall performance of how we are operating. Overall performance meaning that what is the rate of those who are being arrested, how are we doing internal home, what's the biological management status and so forth. So releasing to the nature is important. And I think since we have stuck to our guns on that matter, there's been real success that we're beginning to realize. So the coaches are getting confused a bit, because they plan ahead of us as well. When you do certain things and messaging certain things differently than they do. So I thought I should touch on that point, because there was pressure also from the quarters to say release everything. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Honorable Minister and your team, for thought-provoking presentations. I'm sure that the members and the guests, they are itching to engage with the issues that has been presented. But we will just take note and then we'll come back later. There was an article in The Guardian of UK which wrote extensively about the proposals on Swaziland this week. the proposal from Swaziland that has been submitted to SAITI on the opening of trades on the horn and the rhino and ivory that the Swaziland is arguing that most of those who are for conservation and for the total ban do not understand the complexities of conserving these species and they need to invest resources towards conservation. So that's the argument of Swaziland is going to be subjected to the debate. I'm sure we also have our own proposal, but we'll engage with that later on. Can we have the last presentation before we break for tea? Mr. Douglas, I don't want to pronounce your name incorrectly, Mr. Angus Sholto Douglas, from the Private Rhino Owners Association, who's going to be talking to us about managing the challenges in managing private rhino reserves. Over to you.
Thanks very much, Chair. Honourable Minister, Honourable Members, Honourable MEC, thanks very much for the opportunity. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Well, I come from there, just from Umphuleni. That's my normal name, and it takes away all that long stuff. That just confuses the people and myself, I think. Representing today Wildlife Branch in South Africa and the Private Rhino Owners Association, many of you may know that there's an international wildlife ranching symposium in Namibia this week. So this is why you see this unfamiliar face around the table. Thank you very much for the opportunity anyway. It is always a great pleasure for me to talk about anything to do with rhino. The background to it is Dr. Pereira has...
just a little bit. The presentation will be circulated later and told. So if we can just look at the passport there in front of us.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Certainly a lot prettier looking in this direction. As Dr. Pereira has pointed out, some of the statistics regarding private rhino ownership in South Africa, and I think the most important figure there is that private rhino owners own roughly a third of the national rhino population. That figure is probably a little bit outdated now, and I think we'll all see it as being rather conservative. But in terms of the rest of Africa, you will in fact see that private rhino ownership is greater than the rest of Africa, which makes it a significant percentage of the continental herd. The statistics are that there are now 330 private rhino reserves, comprising around 2 million hectares. The concerning figure there is that there used to be 400. And we're starting to see a decline in the number of properties, private properties with rhino on them. And we'll touch on some of the reasons of why that is happening. But in terms of poaching incidents, roughly around 80% of the properties have had poaching incidents. 280 of them have had incidents that would be a threat to human life. What are the factors that are now influencing private rhino ownership and why are we seeing a decline? Well, the first and most importantly is the financial implications that are of the second point, risk and poaching. And then, of course, the amount of law enforcement that's required to protect the private populations. We're starting to see the financial implications of private rhino ownership growing all the time. The loss of the 300 million rands worth of assets, an escalation in security costs, and if you couple these together, you get significant loss and significant cost. So the ownership really now is in a risk paradigm, where we're starting to see a loss not only of hectares, but also starting to see a loss of the number of populations. And once again, I stress that in excess of 70 properties that used to have rhino now no longer have rhino. Now, you could say that some of these may have been moved to safer properties. Some of them may have been moved into other countries within the safe region. But essentially, just the growth of the number of rhino populations in the 1970s was one of the core factors that led to rhinos breeding very quickly in population vacuums. So as soon as one sees loss of properties and a loss of the number of populations, it should be an alarm bell. So if you look at the impact of poaching on private ownership, 1,200 of the 6,000 rhino poached have been on private land. Once again, the same asset loss. And then if one had to equate it to a horn value, it's around 1 billion rand. And we see this with an exponential increase in security costs. If you start looking at those types of figures, it gives you an idea of the type of pressure that the private rhino ownership is under. These factors lead to the distinct sale of remaining rhino on the properties. We see an issue where a rancher will maybe have 15 to 20 animals, one or two of them are poached. He looks at the situation and decides this is far too risky, and as opposed to enhancing his security, he feels he's already at a loss and he decides to distress sell the population. Many of these animals have been sold into Namibia, and some of them have been donated into Botswana as well. There is now a developing, and I think this speaks to the messaging that we were talking about earlier, there is now a negative perception around ownership. It's due to the risk, obviously, risk to employees and risk to the security of the property and the people on it. We also see substantive increases in properties that have decided to maintain their rhino herds. So I will, for one, know that some property that I have the privilege of managing, we've seen a 500% increase in budget over the last 3 years, just to try and make sure that our population is secure. And we have to look at the sustainability of that on a property such as ours. It has had a severely massive impact on reserve profitability. And speaks to the deployment of staff and security responsibility. We have essentially become single species managers or single species conservationists. It puts other projects on hold because you funnel all your money into the priority, which is making sure that your rhinos are safe. And based on that, we need to deploy higher levels of security. We need to invest in the technology to protect them. And on top of that, we need to run our own informal networks. So this is one thing that we look at in the background of what I just pointed out. I think we will all agree that it's critical to maintain private rhino ownership. If you own a third of the population and more rhinos than the rest of Africa, the end result is that you must maintain private rhino ownership. And how do we do that? And once we've done that, if we want populations to increase, how do we encourage rhino custodianship? We need to shift the private paradigm from not wanting to have rhinos to wanting to have rhinos, so that we can create space for rhinos to breed. That's the crux of it. And the other point that I've put in on my own desk is, how do we improve not only the security of private reserves, but the responsibility that ranchers have to those rhinos? Sometimes when we look at things from the outside, our immediate response, particularly in a private rhino poaching incident, is to say, is to feel an enormous amount of pity for the owner, because it's probably one of the most awful things you'll go through. But then if we look just that little bit deeper and say, how is the rancher taking the level of responsibility for the security of those animals? And is there a minimum standard that we should be looking at? I know many years ago when we acquired a population of black rhinoceros from Ezimvelo, we actually had to give a stipulation of how many guards we had per 1,000 hectares. And that was in 2001, somewhere around there. So should that not be part of a permit framework as well? Should we not be looking at some form of accreditation? from the department. Just like Dr. Barrera, obviously the financial sustainability comes through, you know, as the opportunity to come through a regulated horn aid mechanism. The chair of the Proud Rhino Owners Association would probably like me to expand on it a little bit more, but I think we all know that that is something that the private rhino owners have looked at and seen, the majority have seen as a possible solution to funding the security required to look after these animals. Support of enabling legislation and law enforcement policies. We need to make it easy for people to have private, to have rhino populations, and we need to somehow make them want to do it as well. Once again, I touch on the responsibility of private rhino owners. The greater levels of cooperation between state, provincial, and private rhino custodians, which I think in times of crisis you're seeing now is probably at an all-time high. Sometimes we see the populations distinctly divorced from each other, whereas they are all in fact part of the native population and the national herd. My pet is always a more cohesive rhino management community as well, in the broader sense, recognizing the differences of approach that all have a role in reducing the rhino poaching. Mr. Chairman, thank you very much for your time. I hope that I've assisted you in catching up with my brief presentation. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for your presentation. I think it does help in giving a perspective from the point of view of the private rhino owners. Of course, what is going through your presentation is a consideration about cost. Because as a private sector, you come in from the point of view of certainly belief of your establishment. So it's quite clear that the cost has been going up from 2008. I saw the figure of 1.4 billion there. As a, yeah, billion, 1.4 billion, which had to be invested around security issues. Colleagues, I think we can break for tea for about 5 minutes and then come back and engage. I think we'll have an opportunity to just do the stretch the legs and then come back a bit more refreshed to engage. I hope the members have been taking notes and the colleagues generally. So we can just wait for tea for 5 minutes and come back.
So what is your end goal? I'm a journalist, so you're always ask each other, what's your end goal? And I'm sure to come out of the discussion now, because whenever there's colloquiums or workshops with civil society and other groups, they always ask for other people.
Yeah. So,
the
fact that he's opening this up,
yeah, I'm trying to find where they are.
Yeah. Because we have a team of four senior monitors,
yeah.
So we permanently stop it. Yeah.
So all the other hand people are probably
they're not all, yeah, they're all part time. Open Society Foundation. Yeah. All the big international
NGOs. The government has to do it. Exactly, to maintain independence.
Yeah. I mean, they pay subscriptions. Well, Parliament India pays subscriptions with us now. But other governments, but I don't know why. No, because it's really not that expensive. And it's actually using a big thing because there's so many stuff that comes to me to really need the stuff. So now I have no access to it.
You only have one entrance. You've got the independent oversight of the top one.
Yeah.
Do they have an internal?
Mm-hmm.
I guess they're open to see. So the only people monitoring Parliament are just communities. Parliament themselves, so you can update their website.
Yeah. I mean, they're supposed to have like media offices or whatever at the time to like to the committee. But they.
Has the sign up for the idea been pitched before? Huh? So selling up the whole
team. I don't think it's been open to public.
I don't want to make it like a BP4 crisis, but it's hugely severe.
You should speak to Dr. Sam, you should ask him like that.
I don't think no, I'm just making a possible. Yeah. by selling the loans. They should just complain about that. I don't think the market is eating all that. They're not legalizing that one.
And we are a SIP signatory, so we can't operate outside of what they
stipulate.
So the mandate inside you is we can't trade in the international, the same trade as you. But we put a moratorium on our footprint.
This
was
the 2008. The moratorium was solved.
Correct.
He's an earlier market. So either way, we all had some
fun.
Then why are they talking about what is